This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Children of Eden, a novel by Joey Graceffa. Read by Sarah Grayson with an introduction by the author.
Hello there. I'm Joey Graceffa, the author of Children of Eden, the book you're about to listen to, and I guess thank you so much for buying my book. I think you're really going to enjoy this. So, money well spent. So I've always loved telling stories, whether it be stories in my head, stories that I tell through music videos or vlogs or short films. But now I wanted to take a story to the next level by creating a book. So this story takes place in a futuristic world where humanity has destroyed itself, destroyed the planet, and the last chance of survival is in this city of Eden. The artificial and synthetic city of Eden is completely surrounded by a giant wasteland. And to keep everyone in the city of Eden alive and prosperous, there's some crazy laws put in place that actually make the life of my main character Rowan extremely difficult. I'm really excited because Sarah Grayson, who is a voice from one of my favorite games, is actually going to be reading my book to you guys. And she has such a cool voice, and she really captured the world of Eden and really captured Rowan's voice. I'm so excited for you to listen to this story and enjoy, and welcome to the Children of Eden.
1. "Give me more," I insist, pounding my fist on the gleaming steel of the outdoor dining table. Above us, the stars glimmer through the nanoparticle haze that keeps us safe from the ruined atmosphere. Across the table from me, my brother Ash's eyes twinkle. "The priests say our ancestors ruined the planet that way, Rowan. More, more, always more, until the Earth couldn't give any more and she died." He grins. He's teasing me, I know. But I see the secret shudder that always makes his body tremble when he thinks of the eco-fail. He's an avid temple-goer, and spends hours on his knees in penance for the acts of our ancestors. Not that it does much good. The atmosphere is as broken as ever. The world is dead. And only the tender care of the eco-panopticon keeps us alive now. Praying will never make a tree grow in this world again. The Earth is dead. But we still survive. Of course, I've never been to temple. Maybe if I had, I wouldn't be such a cynic. But then I haven't been anywhere in the last 16 years. At least not officially. You see, I don't exist. I might as well be a figment of my twin brother's imagination. If I were, I think he would have gone inside and fallen asleep long ago. Figments are easier to shake than I am. Ash knows I never give up. Through long habit, and Mom's insistence, he is used to devoting a good chunk of every day to my persistent questions. For a girl who doesn't exist, I can be a pain in the neck. Or so Ash tells me, almost every day. I smile wickedly at my brother. "More," I tell him again. When he hesitates, I spring on him, toppling him backward. The chair thuds on the thick carpet of moss that my mother so carefully maintains. Ash tries to roll out of the way, but we're the same height, and much to his embarrassment, I'm a little bit stronger than he is. "More," I shout, as I pin him down. "Tell me more." I begin to tickle him, and he squirms until we're both near hysterical. "That's enough," comes the gentle voice of our mother from the veranda. "Do you want the neighbors to hear?" That quiets us quickly. Even though there's almost no chance of our laughter penetrating the high, thick stone walls around my family's compound, it would be a disaster if anyone knew I was here. Oh, Mom could probably pass the girlish laughter off as coming from one of Ash's visiting friends, even though we almost never have visitors. When we do, I have to run to one of the many hidden nooks and walled-off secret chambers my parents have improvised all through the house. But there's always a chance some nosy neighbor will check the regional scans and put two and two together. That would be the end of me. Literally. I help Ash to his feet and sit down across from him. in a more decorous voice, I do what I do every day. I beg him to tell me about the world outside the family compound. I'm not just hungry for all the experiences I'm missing out on. I'm starving. Ravenous. What did Lark wear today when she changed out of her school uniform? Lark is the girl my brother has a crush on, and I'm fascinated with her. The way he describes her makes her seem so real to me. Almost as if she were my friend, too. Almost as if I were a real person. I know that if we ever met, we'd be instantly close. Every afternoon when Ash comes home, I quiz him about every detail of his day. Academics I learn on my own from vids and data blocks. I'm more interested in the people. The tiniest details enrapture me. Did your environmental history professor flirt with the headmaster today? Did the auto loop attendant smile when she scanned your eyes on the way to school? Did Brooke chew his laver cakes with his mouth open again? These are the friends I'll never have, and I love them all. Unfortunately, Ash isn't always good at the details I crave. When I ask what Lark wore, he only says, something yellow. Bright yellow? Pale yellow? I press eagerly. Lemon or buttercup or sunshine? Of course, no one has seen lemons or buttercups since before the eco-fail. I don't know, just kind of medium yellow, I guess. A dress? I fling myself dramatically back in the chair. Ugh, you're useless! Ash, bless him, can never quite understand how all those things that are so trivial to him can mean the world to me. He does his best, he really does. But it's never good enough. Between the two of us, we're trying to build a shadow life for a shadow girl. I have to be ready for the glorious day I will finally emerge into the light. If that day ever comes. Mom and Dad always assure me it will, someday. 16 years of assurances later, someday still hasn't arrived. I look at my brother as he struggles to recall the details of his day, so I can feel like I'm part of the real world. He is my mirror, almost exactly like me. He has the same night dark hair, the strong chin softened by a dimple, the light bronze skin. He's told me that he doesn't like his face, that his features are too delicate for a boy. Maybe if I knew more of the world, I think my face was too strong for a girl. Our main difference is in our jaws, I think. In both of us, they're sharply angled and strong. But when Ash worries about something, he works his jaw like he's chewing on the problem, like it's a tough nut he's trying to crack. I learned about nuts in an environmental history vid. Food growing on trees. Can you imagine? Me, when I'm upset, my jaw gets tight and still. I just clench my teeth until the muscles in my cheeks ache. Been clenching my jaw a lot lately. There are two other obvious differences between us, other than our gender, of course. Ash's eyes are flat, reflective blue-gray, like our mother's. Mine are a strange shifting color that seems to alternate from green to blue to gold, depending on the light. When I look closely in a mirror, I can see a starburst of amber in the middle of the blue, flecks and streaks like meteors shooting across an azure sky. My eyes have given me away in a heartbeat if anyone ever saw them. Soon after birth, children have their eyes corrected with lens implants. This is because human eyes have evolved to withstand exposure to certain wavelengths of light. Now that the atmosphere is damaged, we're exposed to increased low-band ultraviolet radiation, which can harm untreated eyes. The surgery implants a filter that protects everyone's eyes from the rays. It takes a long time to cause damage, but if someone doesn't get the surgery, they will eventually go blind. I haven't noticed any damage yet, but I'm told around 30 my vision will start to dim. The filter is coded to identify every resident of Eden with a quick scan. Of course, I couldn't have the surgery, so my eyes are still their natural color. Sometimes when Ash looks at me too long, I see him blink and shake his head, and I know that they unnerve him. My father, whose own eyes are dead brown like a wall, can hardly look at me. The other difference between Ash and me wouldn't be apparent to anyone. He's older than me. Only by about 10 minutes, but that's enough. It means that he is the official legal child, the firstborn. I am the shameful second child, who never should have come into this world at all. Ash goes inside to finish his homework. My lessons, assigned by Mom, and closely paralleling Ash's, were done hours before he even came home. Now, as the night deepens, I began to pace restlessly around the courtyard. We live in one of the inner circles, just beyond the center, because my parents are both in the government. It's a huge house, much bigger than we need. But whenever Dad talks about selling it, or dividing it into parcels to lease, Mom shuts him down. It's her house, inherited from her parents. Unlike most buildings in Eden, ours is made of stone. When I put my hands on it, I can almost feel the earth breathing against me. It's alive, somehow. More alive, anyway, than the metal and concrete and solar cells that comprise the other buildings in Eden. These stones have been in dirt, I think. Real dirt, with worms and roots and life. None of us in Eden has experienced such natural circumstances. The moss that carpets the walled courtyard is alive, but it isn't a real plant. It doesn't need dirt. It doesn't have roots, only thread-like anchors that help it to cling to rock. It doesn't take its nutrients from the ground, but from the air. Like everything in Eden, it is separate from the earth. Still, it is growing, living, and as my feet pace along its carpeted softness, a sharp, fresh smell rises to meet my nose. If I close my eyes, I can almost imagine I'm in one of the forests that died almost 200 years ago. As chief archivist in the Central Records Division, Mom has access to the oldest records, the ones from before the eco-fail. My data block lessons only have graphic illustrations of the way things used to be, but Mom told me that in the secret chambers of the archives, there are images, ancient and crumbling, of tigers and lambs and palm trees and meadows full of wildflowers. They are so old and precious that they're kept in a static-free room and handled only with gloves. She gave me one. She could have gotten locked up for doing so. But the photo probably never would be missed, and she thought I deserved something special for my years in captivity. One day when she was going through the records, she found an undocumented image of a night sky over a great chasm. Tucked behind another document, it was labeled with a date immediately before the eco-fail. Stars don't look like anything I've ever seen. There are thousands of them, swimming in a milky sea. And beneath them, I can make out the contours of trees clinging to the rocky ridge. It is a vastness I can scarcely comprehend. Eden is big, but I can bisect the city in an auto loop in half a day. The ancient folded image my mother smuggled out for me shows a world. The world, in fact. It's my most precious possession. Because my mother had seen such things, she cherishes living organisms even more than most. The majority of households, Ash tells me, make do with cheerful neon green turf and plasticized trees. But Mom prefers to get as close as possible to the real thing, even if it isn't as pretty. Besides the moss, we have chunks of rock covered in white and pink lichens. A creeping black slime mold coils its way up an abstract sculpture. And at the center of the courtyard is a shallow pool, where red and green sheets of algae swirl continuously in an artificial current. Mine is a luxurious house, large and comfortable, but a large, comfortable prison is still a prison. I know I shouldn't think of it that way. Home should be thought of as a sanctuary, and the alternative to having a home is too horrible to even consider. But all the same, I can't shake my sense of entrapment. With so many lonely hours to fill, I've learned to schedule my days tightly. Empty time leads to daydreaming, and daydreams are dangerous for a person in my position. Schoolwork, art, and exercise are all arranged in regular sequence, so I don't have too much time to yearn for what I can't have. Right now, it's too dark to draw or paint, and I feel as though I've read every book in the database. So I run. In the dim starlight, I can just make out the faint path where I run miles every day. The moss is resilient. That's why it is one of the few kinds of vegetation that survived the eco-fail. But even it loses its spring under the onslaught of my feet. As I run, the steady hypnotic pounding centers me. I can feel the blood start to move more quickly through my veins. When I push my body, I feel alive. Alive when almost all the world is dead. But what good is it to be alive when I'm trapped? Frustrated, I run faster, taking the corners of the courtyard hard enough to kick up bits of moss. Mom will be mad, but I don't care. I am matter. Furious. Just because of some stupid law. I'm hidden away behind walls. A pariah who will be slaughtered or enslaved if I'm ever discovered. Movement usually makes me feel better, but tonight it is torment. I'm so sick of running in the same rectangle, clockwise, then counterclockwise. With a cry of frustration, I begin to zigzag, sprinting faster and faster, jumping over the lichen-covered rocks, the chairs, leaping to the tabletop and springing off again. All at once, I feel like I can't breathe. The high walls seem to close in on me, like a giant mouth about to crush me with stony teeth. I dash one way, then the other, crashing into walls, pounding them with my fists, almost snarling in bitter frustration. I know I'm spinning out of control, but I can't help myself. Most of the time, I'm somber, regulated, content. But sometimes for reasons I don't quite understand, I become enraged at my situation. It's the strangest thing. But what bothers me most is that Ash couldn't describe Lark's outfit. It's so stupid, so trivial, but it gnaws at me that, with all his privileges and freedom, he couldn't bother to take note of the one thing that mattered to me. Why does that little detail matter so much? I don't understand it. Ash does the best he can, and it can't be easy having to give up most of his social life so he can regale his secret sister with stories of the outside world. He must resent me sometimes. Yet tonight, I resent him. And that makes me feel guilty, and even madder. At myself, at the center and its laws that took everything away from me. Even at the ecopan that keeps us all alive. I have to get away from these walls. I have to break free. With an animal gasp of relief, I begin to climb a wall, digging my fingers into the handholds I know so well, jamming my toes into crevices where the mortar has crumbled. I climb these walls as part of the physical conditioning my mother insists on. Almost every night I would pull myself up to the top, some 30 feet above the ground, and slyly peer over the edge. Tonight, that isn't enough. Not nearly enough. Without so much as a moment's hesitation, I fling a leg over the rough stones and sit straddling the wall. One leg imprisoned, the other free. No one will see me. No one will look up. I'm feeling reckless as I gaze out at Eden stretched before me, its concentric circles looking like some strange glyph carved into the land. Instead of trees, tall spires of algae protein synthesizers jut hundreds of feet above the highest building. The vibrant circles just beyond the center are lit with bioluminescence that shows off the abundant greenery that carpets the city. Most of the city is equipped with artificial photosynthesis, engineered to act almost as real plants and convert the carbon dioxide we exhale into breathable oxygen. Some of it's like what Mom cultivates in our courtyard. Hardy mosses and fungi. Decorative algae swirling in liquid mediums. Even in the near dark, it is a green city. If I didn't know better, I might be fooled into thinking that it is a thriving ecosystem instead of an artificial survival pod. What isn't green glitters. Unlike our stone house, most buildings are made of polymers and coated in either clear or reflective photovoltaic panels that convert sunlight into energy to power our city. In the daylight, Eden shines like a giant emerald. At night, it looks more like a huge green eye, darkly bright with hidden secrets. Past the rings of the luxurious inner circles comes the less elegant outer circle. Here in the inner circles, where we live just beyond the center, the houses are large and fine. Near the boundary, though, the houses grow smaller, more tightly packed. No one would ever starve in Eden. The Ecopanopticon makes sure of that. But from what Mom and Ash told me, life is not nearly as comfortable near the boundary as it is here, near the center. Even at this height, I can't begin to see as far as the boundary of Eden. But I know from my lessons what lies there. Desert, burning and merciless. And beyond that, a wasteland far worse. Compared to my courtyard, Eden is an infinity. It is so big, and I am so small. The city teems with people. I am just a particle in that cosmos of humanity. All my life, I've only ever met 3 people. The idea of meeting anyone new, frankly, terrifies me, even more than the very real possibility of being caught. Strangers seem like dangerous animals. But in a world without life, I would risk being torn and rendered by fearsome fangs just for the chance to see a real-life tiger up close. I would give anything, even my own life, to experience what I've been missing out on. I thought about going out so many times. There are days when I think of nothing else, when the lure of freedom consumes my thoughts, and I can't draw, or study, or run. Now, tonight, more than ever before, as I think about that one detail about Lark's outfit, and how Ash doesn't know it, and I don't know it, and I may never know it, Eden seems to call me with its strongest voice yet. And though I'm terrified, I swing my other leg over the edge of the wall, my elation overpowering my terror. Two. As I poise on the precipice between safety and freedom, about to descend into the unknown, I hear a small sound, the melodious chime of three notes that announces someone is at our door. Beck! I curse under my breath. I freeze, and the air around me is suddenly cold. Did someone see me? Is it the green shirts coming for me? I try to steady my breathing. It's probably just a delivery, or maybe a messenger from the hospital, come to fetch my father for emergency surgery. Then Ash creeps into the courtyard. I see him look around, quickly. And when he doesn't immediately spot me, again, more slowly. I whistle softly, a bird call I heard on a vid, and he looks up. You have to hide, he hisses urgently. He has a center uniform on. My eyes fly open wide, and for a moment I feel like I'm pinned to the wall, immobile and helpless. Hurry, Ash says, and even from up here, I can tell he's panicking. It's only because I climb this wall every day that I can make my way down so fast. Even so, I push out and let myself drop the last few feet, landing in a light crouch. Who is it? I ask as we sprint together into the house. He only shrugs, and I hear a rasping sound as my brother breathes. Nerves and even this small amount of running are making his lungs act up. You have to go straight for your inhaler, I insist, suddenly more worried about him than myself. He slows down, but shakes his head. Gotta get you safe, he gasps. No, I say too loudly. I'll be fine. But if you code out, I won't be fine. Can you make it upstairs by yourself? His breathing is ragged. These attacks, mostly brought on by stress, come only rarely. But every time it happens, I'm sure I'm going to lose my brother. I force my face to stay calm, because I know that any kind of worry will only make him worse at this point. He nods, not wanting to waste his breath on speaking. Okay then, you go, and I'll use the wall hideout. There are four hiding places in our large and sprawling house. The best of them, a small cellar, has a trap door that has to be closed from above, and then concealed under a carpet and heavy chair. Next best is a secret recess in a wall behind a bookcase that looks immovable, but can swing out on pneumatic gliders. Unfortunately, that mechanism has a design flaw, in that it has to be operated from the outside. So both of those depend on someone outside to seal me in, and release me again. That means I have to go either up to the attic, which is spacious and comfortable, but also one of the first places someone would search, or into an insufferably narrow space between two walls. The gap, no more than a foot and a half wide, used to hold some kind of ventilation system that was modernized and moved at some point in the house's history. Now only the old air vent remains, and serves as an access port to a place that is so uncomfortable it makes torture sound like fun. Ash is gasping now. I take his arm and guide him to the foot of the stairs that lead to his room. Our room, really. I have a bedroom of sorts, but there's nothing of my own in it. It's a guest room, which I make up every morning, just as if no one has slept there in weeks. If anyone ever came to inspect the house, they'd find nothing more than a neat, generic bedroom waiting for a visitor. For everything other than sleeping, Ash and I have more or less shared a room since childhood. Shared everything, really. Any personal possessions I have are in Ash's bedroom, hidden among his things. They all look like things a boy might have. I can't have too many possessions of my own. Imagine if someone came in and found a bedroom with dresses and holo posters of shirtless pop stars and all the other things other girls probably have in their rooms. Dead giveaway. Ash and I even share most of our clothes. I don't want to let Ash go. He feels my hold on his arm tighten. Sees the fear in my eyes I can't quite hide. I'm hardly even thinking about the unexpected visitor. You go hide, he says in a raspy whisper. I can make it. I'm not sure he's right, but I don't have any more time to spare. I hear the quiet whine of the front door sliding open, and then the murmur of unfamiliar voices. With a final worried glance at Ash hauling himself up the stairs, I whirl and run for the closet sanctuary, hoping I'll be in time. I have to crawl backward on my belly through the low ventilation access door into an impossibly cramped space. If I go forward, I won't be able to close the door myself. I have only about an inch of clearance on either side. As I snap the door shut, I remember that I was running on moss, climbing on rocks just a moment before. Did I leave any telltale marks on the floor outside my hiding place? Too late to check now. I slither backwards on my elbows and toes, an inch at a time, for several feet, until I reach the place where the crevice opens up enough for me to stand. It's a little better here, but not much. Unlike my other hiding spots, this one isn't built for any kind of comfort. It's like an emergency bolt hole. We run periodic drills, Mom timing me to make sure I can access all four of my hiding places quickly. But I've never had to use this one before. It's the last resort. I have room to stand, and that's about it. Each time I breathe, my chest and back press against the plaster of the wall. It smells odd in here, stale and close. I've gotten used to having a limited life, but this is a little extreme. My vista ends about 3 inches away from my eyes. But I'm safe, hidden away, just in time. I hear an unfamiliar voice coming nearer. I'm surprised I can hear it so clearly. The walls must be thinner than I thought. For a crazy second, I think about knocking on the wall, sending a mysterious message like an unseen spirit. Mom has told me ghost stories, gleaned from records in the archives. In the days of ignorance, people believed in all kinds of things. I don't believe the old tales, but I've always liked hearing them. But if Ash is right, this is a center official. They're known for having zero patience with superstition or anything to do with the way we lived before the eco-fail. Not to mention, of course, the whole threat of death thing if I'm discovered. So I stand at attention in my narrow sliver of safety, upright and alert like a green shirt recruit, and wait for the all clear. When I hear the distinctive sound of people settling themselves in our living room, I figure the all clear will be a long time coming. I sigh, and my breath bounces against the wall back to me, warming my face. I don't know exactly what I'm expecting out of the unknown visitor. Probably something terse and official. Most likely they've come by for some after-hours emergency, or what passes as an emergency. Maybe Mom needs to sign off on the duplication and distribution of some pre-fail artifact. Or Dad has to authorize one of the restricted drugs for an upper-level center official. Usually they message ahead, either calling on the Unicom, or sending a message bot to herald their approach, giving me time to hide. What can be so urgent that it has to be a surprise? Whenever I expect, certainly not the sound of weeping from my mother. She sounds like she's right on the other side of this wall, and I actually take a step forward, stubbing my toe. Do they hear? No, I don't think so. Because the stranger speaks. I hear him clearly through the wall. 1 week, he says. I frown in puzzlement. What's happening in a week to make Mom cry? So soon? Mom asks, despair in her voice. Dad immediately cuts in. We've been waiting almost 17 years, he says gruffly. Not nearly soon enough, if you ask me. Almost 17 years? Are they discussing something about me? Must be. Either me or Ash. You understand there have been difficulties, the stranger says, placating. Though I can tell from his voice he must be a little annoyed, too. Black market lenses are just the beginning. Half the criminals in Eden can get fake lenses that show another person's identity on a level 1 scan. The problem is creating a new identity. We paid you enough, Dad snaps. It should have been done long before now. Hush, Mom says to him. She sniffs hard, and I can tell she's trying to pull herself together. Go on, Mr. Hill. Please tell us the rest. I don't care how we did it, as long as it's done, I hear my father say in an undertone. I can picture his face, impatient and peevish as it so often is, his eyes restlessly glancing sidelong. A week, you said. Why not sooner? I hear the doorbell chime, and my mom gasp, at exactly the same time. So I can't tell whether she is shocked by that, or by what my father has said. Are you expecting anyone? The stranger asks in evident alarm. I'm wedged in my tight nook, blind and stifled. But in my mind's eye, I can see clear as day the way Mom and Dad exchange a quick look. Their relationship isn't always perfect, I know. But they do have that trick of silent communication. I've often wondered if other couples can do this, hold rapid unspoken conversations with a glance, and reach a conclusion without a word. I wonder if I'll ever know someone that well. I hear a quick movement through the wall, and a startled sound from the stranger. I realize he's being hustled upstairs to my attic hideaway. Whoever he is, at least he'll be more comfortable than I am. Mom rushes back a moment later, and when she talks in a hushed, urgent voice, I realize Dad hasn't gone to answer the door yet. Will they find him? She asks. How should I know? He snaps. I don't know who they are or what they want. Probably just someone from work. Mom sighs in frustration at his optimism. But why now, of all times? We should get him out of the house. He's a center official, Dad counters. Why shouldn't he be here? He could be my friend. No, they might be watching him. If he's involved in the black market, we can't afford to be linked to him. Not when we're this close. They'll get suspicious. They'll get more suspicious if we don't open the door soon, Dad says, rightly enough. Where's Rowan? Did she make it to the basement? I don't know, but she's sensible enough to stay out of sight until one of us comes for her. Go have a drink and join us in a few minutes. If anyone sees your face now, they'll know something's wrong. I hear the heavy tread of his feet as he goes to the front door. The living room is completely still now, and I can hear the sound of my own breathing again. For a moment, I think Mom has left, her lighter step unhurt. Then I hear a little scratching on the wall just outside my nook. She knows I'm here, or she thinks I'm here. Gingerly, I scratch back, once, twice. I hear a gentle sigh from the other side, and I feel a love so overwhelming I would sit down if I had room. Dad has done whatever is necessary to keep me safe. But it's always been Mom who let me know that everything she did, everything she sacrificed for me, was done from love, not obligation or fear or necessity. She walks away with a deliberately heavy step, so I'll know she's gone. Still, in this moment, because of her love, I don't feel alone. I don't feel trapped. I feel safe. But it isn't long before my sense of safety evaporates entirely. I hear the clump of multiple pairs of boots. No, I can't be entirely certain. I bet anything that they're green shirts. The police force of Eden. Ash always makes a joke of the green shirts, telling me how they chase down kids who hijack the public lighting system to spell out rude words like T-Zack and Kofaz, or break into the lichen gardens after hours with their girlfriends. Maybe the green shirts are benign to kids pulling childish pranks. But I know that they are really a deadly civil defense squad, whose main purpose is to root out anything that goes against the survival mandates of the Ego Panopticon. And that's pretty much the definition of me. Green shirts patrol the streets and investigate any crimes that happen in Eden. They're more heavily concentrated in the outer circles, far from the center where people are poor and more desperate. But they're here in the inner circles, too. I've glimpsed them a couple of times from the top of the wall, stomping in black-booted pairs along the avenues. I always duck down quickly, and usually don't risk popping my head up again for a few days after every sighting. I've never been spotted, though, by them or anyone else. No one on the streets ever looks up, and I confine myself to the uncertain light of dusk and dawn. Now there are almost certainly green shirts in my living room. What if they're here for me? Did someone spot my peeking head after all and grow suspicious? Could Ash have been careless and let a word drop into the wrong ears? If they have discovered my existence, I am hopelessly, helplessly trapped. There is only one exit out of this hiding place, and simply squirming out would be a struggle. I wouldn't have a hope of flight. I can picture their black boots waiting outside the grate, almost feel them grabbing me to drag me away to some awful unknown fate. There's some kind of bot with them, too. I hear the whir and beep of one of the smaller models. Is it a security bot come to sniff me out? What is it doing here? Bots are nosy. They can be trouble. Then I hear a silky voice speaking social pleasantries. Its unique upper-class center accent, marking the speaker as one of the Eden elite. The voice sounds familiar, but I can't place it until Dad addresses him by his title. "Please, have a seat, Chancellor," my father says, his voice more polite and deferential than I've ever heard it. As the Physician General, he is a high-ranking government minister himself, and looks down on most of Eden. The bot rolls across the floor, coming closer to my hiding spot. I've heard Chancellor Cornwall's voice on news feeds, seen the man himself on vids. I remember that wherever he appears, he has a cohort of green shirts standing guard behind him. What is the head of the government doing in our house? Part of me is starkly terrified. The other part is almost reassured. A hidden second child might be a serious, even capital offense, but it certainly doesn't warrant a visit from the leader of all Eden. He'd just send in a green shirt strike force to capture me. He wouldn't be standing in my living room while Dad ordered a serve bot to fetch him a cup of faux chai, a fragrant drink made of algae that's genetically modified to taste like pre-failed tea. He must be here for something really terrible. Or really wonderful. Turns out to be both, I think. I listen, amazed, as Chancellor Cornwall tells my father that the current vice-chancellor is resigning due to medical reasons. "I'd be happy to examine him and offer a second opinion," my father ventures, but the chancellor ignores him. "I believe he would serve Eden well as the next vice-chancellor." There is dead silence in the room. My father, who came from an outer ring of inner city, has risen high in the government ranks to become physician general. It was mostly by his skill as a surgeon, I always thought. But apparently Dad has been playing a deeper political game than I ever realized. Why else would the Chancellor notice him? My father makes occasional pronouncements about health, monitors public policy on mandatory sterility surgeries and vaccinations, and occasionally provides personal treatment to ranking members of the government and their families. This is a surprise to me. Perhaps it is to Dad, too. He always seems to keep as low a profile as he can, given his position. By position, I mean me, his shameful secret. He keeps his head down and doesn't socialize or network as much as other people in government. He can't exactly host cocktail parties with me hiding in his cellar, can he? But somehow, he's attracted notice. The silence hangs too long. At last, my father says, "I would be honored to serve Eden in any capacity." His voice is tight, and I wonder if it's from humility or nerves. They speak of this for a while, and I listen, almost forgetting about the first visitor, wondering what all this will mean for my family. Will Dad have to move to the center like all the uppermost center officials? Will we? Impossible. My safety depends entirely on this house. Then I hear the small bot roll across the room, pausing right near the vent. I hold my breath. Has it spotted something suspicious? Some sign of my existence? I don't know what kind of bot it is, but if it is a variety with good visual acuity, it might be able to actually see me if it scans directly into the tiny opening in the vent. It inches closer, and beeps. If a bot can sound uncertain, this one does. Then the Chancellor says, "I won't take up any more of your time. Let me know what you decide by tomorrow morning." The green shirt guards wheel in formation. The Chancellor snaps his fingers. The bot glides away after him, and the room is quiet. Though my legs are stiffening and the air is growing stale with my breath, I don't dare leave until I receive the all-clear signal. It takes so long, I think they've forgotten about me. When I scramble out, covered in a light dusting of plaster, Mom is waiting for me in the living room. She's alone. I have so many questions about the first center visitor, about the Chancellor, that I don't know where to start. But first, most important, is Ash. He was having an attack. Is he okay? My jaw is clenched tightly as I wait for the answer. It takes a long time coming. At first, that makes me think it's going to be terrible news. I just checked on him, and he's resting comfortably, she says. I sigh with relief. Somehow the rest doesn't seem to matter as much now. That feeling lasts for all of 30 seconds. Mom looks at me in silence for a long moment. What's going to happen? I finally blurt out. It's an all-encompassing question. Mom's answer shakes me to my core. It's like all of my dreams and nightmares are coming true at once. They've made lenses with a new identity, Rowan. I wait for her to smile. She doesn't, and I tense. Mom pauses again, and then says gently, And they found a new family for you. You leave in 1 week. My legs give out and I sink to the floor. My back pressed against the very wall that hid me just moments before. Three. No, I say weakly. I've waited for the freedom to move all my life, and now... No! I cry again, smashing the back of my fist against the wall. Sorrow and anger are building inside me, fighting for control. I decide to let anger win for once. I won't do it, I shout. You can't make me leave this family. My family. I jump to my feet and don't know whether to hug my mom or punch the wall or run for Ash or collapse again. It was always a possibility. I've known that for years. But I always believed there would be another way. I always believed my parents wouldn't let me leave them. Ever. But there were only two fates for a second child. A life hidden away, or a life in a new identity. Well, there is one more. The usual one. Termination after conception. Or after birth. However long after birth the child is discovered. When the Earth died just a little more than 200 years ago, humanity was doomed, along with every other higher animal on the planet. Everything bigger than a paramecium became extinct, and life probably wasn't all that good for the paramecia either. Of course, we humans were the only ones who had it coming. It was our fault. We were the only animals with brains clever enough, and fingers agile enough, to create nuclear power, to frack the Earth, and poison the sea, and spew out chemicals that would destroy the atmosphere. We, intelligent humans that we are, fiddled with the DNA of our crops to make a better soybean that could survive anything and feed the world, until that soybean proved so hardy and aggressive it took over the rainforests. We raised living things for food, forcing them to live as prisoners, walking in their own feces. So we dosed them with antibiotics. Dosed our children, too. And then we were surprised when bacteria mutated into superbugs. We killed the world and ourselves at the same time. The planet began to die. The Earth's temperature jumped 10 degrees in a decade when greenhouse gases trapped the sun's heat, turning our planet into an oven. A team of scientists had the bright idea to inject a revolutionary new product into the atmosphere to fix it. Can you guess how that went? The Earth cooled, all right. But when the sun's radiation reacted with the new man-made atmosphere, it created a cascade reaction that killed nearly every plant and animal on the planet. Except a few of us. Remember our big, clever brains and agile hands? The best thing humans ever did with those assets was to create something smarter and kinder than us. When it became obvious that the Earth was going belly up, a visionary created the Ecopanopticon. The all-seeing guardian of nature. The Ecopanopticon is God and mother and physician and king to us now. We gave it power over us, because we could no longer be trusted with power ourselves. But we don't mind being ruled, because, like a mother, the Ecopan's only goal is to keep us alive. With our flesh and blood and weak, fallible bodies, we didn't stand a chance in this harsh and terrible broken world. But all the things we created went along just fine without us. The man who came up with the idea of the Ecopan, Aaron Elbaz, created an artificial intelligence that would link into every last bit of electronics and internet and communications that we left behind. It completely co-opted the systems we created. The power plants, the reactors, the factories that had destroyed the Earth in the first place, and turned them towards saving the planet. The Ecopan directed factories to make robots, every one of which was linked to its all-seeing global eye. The robots in turn created this sanctuary, Eden, for the few human survivors. At the same time, it went to work on repairing the devastation we'd wrought on the planet. Fixing the world to the point where it was safe for us to live in would take hundreds of years, though. In the meantime, we lived in this paradise that the Ecopan had made for us. Except, as in every paradise, there are a few rules. Break them, and you get tossed out. Because we're a completely closed system, our resources are severely limited. With no plants or animals left to eat, we subsist on the things that were tough enough to live through the ecofail, like algae, fungi, and lichens, as well as synthesized proteins. Everything, and I mean everything, think about that, is recycled, reused, reconsumed. We've been in Eden for just shy of 200 years, and we'll have to be here for at least 1,000 more before Earth normalizes. So we have to be careful. It's funny, humans were almost wiped out, but too many survived. Too many to keep that kind of population alive in Eden for a millennium. So Ecopan figured out our ideal sustainable population, the exact number of people that will keep us going until we can leave Eden. Until we reach that, our numbers have to be gradually diminished. Ecopan, in its wisdom, decreed that there can only be one child born for every two living people of fertile age until we reach the ideal population. Any more than that, and our resources will give out, and the small remnant that is left of the human race will die out once and for all. A more practical artificial intelligence might have culled us at the very beginning, creating the perfect population and then regulating it. But Ecopan loves us like a mother. It decided to save us with as much compassion as possible. And so I, and other second children like me, if there are any, really are monsters, who would doom the human species if we could, simply by our very existence. I feel guilty when I let myself think about it. The food I eat, the air I breathe, the waste I produce, might be the thin edge of the wedge that makes Eden fail. I am one too many. But I'm glad to be alive. And I'll hold on to my own life strongly, selfishly, if Ecopan or anyone else tries to take it from me. Now I start to realize the full implication of my position in this society. Mom takes my hand and pulls me gently to the sofa. Her touch is soothing. I remember when I was much younger, if I ever got sick, it was my father who healed me, but my mother who made me feel better. The touch of her hands, the look of love and kindness in her eyes, is better than any medicine. Now it just screams at me what I will lose by gaining my freedom. It's not worth the price. Every child grows up, she says softly. I can see her lower lip tremble slightly. Everyone leaves home someday. But not like this, I say between clenched teeth. Not forever. She sighs. It's too dangerous for you to stay here. Why? I demand. If you've gotten the false lenses and a new identity for me, why can't I just be that other person and live here? You've lived a very sheltered life, Rowan, she begins, and I snort. Understatement of the year. You don't realize how it is out there. She gestures to the vast city, unseen beyond our high walls. There is always someone watching. Green shirts, center officials, even the most innocuous little cleanbot scouring the streets for refuse. They're all on the lookout for something just a tiny bit off. With your father in such a high position, and apparently about to rise even higher, she makes a face I can't quite interpret. We'll be under tight scrutiny. You'll be taking on the identity of a stranger. It would be almost impossible to concoct a scenario in which a stranger can move in with us. You'd be investigated, and all our hard work over your lifetime would be for nothing. But Mom, I begin. This is life and death, my love, she says, pulling me close. Death if we fail, if anything even goes a little bit wrong, or anyone has even the slightest suspicion. And life for you, a real life, with friends and a job and a family of your own someday, if this works. She's whispering, her cheek pressed against mine. I feel like this is goodbye already. I don't want to leave you in ash, I say miserably. My anger is still dominant, with sadness creeping along slyly at the edges of my fury. You deserve to be in the world, your own person, Mom says. And part of me thinks she's right, but I feel like a starving girl offered a bite of poisoned food. I want to snatch what is offered and swallow it down, because I need it with every fiber of my being. And yet, I don't deserve anything special, I protest. But you do, Mom says, pulling away from me. More than you know. There's something in her tone that makes me stop. What do you mean? I ask cautiously. She bites her lip. Never mind. Mom, I look at her evenly. Tell me. And she does. I wish she hadn't. My world flips upside down as she tells me the story of my birth. When my mom found out she was pregnant, she had just been named chief archivist, and was in the middle of so many projects that she and my father just decided he would be her attending physician. So for the first few months of gestation, Mom didn't miss any meetings at work, and Dad took care of her nutritional monitoring and fetal health scans at home. As long as it was an uncomplicated pregnancy, there wouldn't be any problem. They'd transfer care to a specialist when it came closer to her delivery date. Everything went fine until the third month, when my father heard two heartbeats. What my mom should have done, what the laws of Eden compelled her to do, was immediately report her condition and leave it to a center panel to decide the baby's fate. Most of the time, one would be terminated right away. The panel might make the decision about which would live, if one was obviously healthier than the other, or if a girl or boy was necessary to balance that generation's gender ratio. But other times it would be random. One fetus would live, the other would die before it was born. We couldn't. We just couldn't, she said, tears in her eyes at the memory. You were only 3 inches long. We'd never met you, but we loved you both with all our hearts, and we decided then and there to do whatever it took to keep you both. She says we, but I know, from the way my dad treats me, from the coldness in his eyes when he looks into mine, that there was no we. Mom made the decision. And Dad followed for her sake, because his eyes are never cold when he looks at her. We hid it, and then when I went into labor, we hid that too. We told everyone it came on quickly, that there was no time to go to the hospital, but it actually lasted more than a day. I gave birth in this house, in secret. When you were born first, Rowan, and I looked into your perfect eyes, I knew it was all worth it. All the secrecy and difficulty that had already happened, and was yet to come, all worth it. We would show you to the world, and keep our secondborn a secret, but we'd treasure you both. I was a first child. I stare beyond my mother, looking at the past, at a different history in which I am the real child. I am the one out in the world, with school and friends, and a room of my own with my own things in it. I am the one who laughs and chats with Lark and the others, while Ash. No, I might wish it had been me, but I can't wish it were me instead of him. Then Ash was born, small and almost blue. He didn't breathe for the first minute of his life, and when he did, it was obvious that he was in trouble. Your father diagnosed it immediately as a serious chronic lung condition. Mom nods, as she sees I understand. We had to make him the firstborn, Rowan. We didn't have a choice. Without being in intensive care for the first few months of his life, he wouldn't have survived. There was no way he could have lived if we'd hidden him away. Unspoken in that moment of silence is the other bitter truth. No matter what our birth order, if it had been up to the center officials to decide our fate, they would have chosen me to live, and terminated Ash even after birth. I was strong and healthy, an asset to Eden. He was not. It's probably only because both of his parents are high officials that he was allowed to live at all. For a poor person on the fringe of Eden, a far-flung outer circle, a sickly first child would be eliminated, the parents encouraged to try again. My brain is in a tumult. Angry, terrible thoughts seem to attack my head. Bitter thoughts that are unworthy of me. Unworthy of the love and protection I've known all my life. But I can't keep them at bay. It should have been me. I hardly listen while Mom tells me about what will be happening next. Soon I'll go to a secret surgical center and have my lenses implanted permanently. Then I'll be smuggled to my new family. I don't understand exactly how this is possible. If my own family can't fabricate a story to keep me, how can a stranger? Ash comes downstairs, his hands raised to the wall, but not quite touching it as he walks. As if he doesn't trust his legs to hold him up. He gives me a weak smile. I glance at Mom, and she shakes her head. Ash doesn't know. I want to shout the truth to him. Go hide in the hole, second child. Let me be free, like I should have been all along. I hate myself for thinking this. I can't be in this house anymore. Four. Mom must just think I need a minute alone to process everything she's told me, so she doesn't follow me when I run out to the courtyard. Neither does Ash. I think she must be holding him back. Alone? How can they think I want to be alone when my whole life has been essentially alone? My world is three people, and they are gone all day having lives of their own. I exist in a state of loneliness. Alone. Solitude is the very last thing I need. What I need and decide suddenly is everything that has been denied to me. I feel angry, resentful, reckless. For nearly 17 years, I've left my fate up to my parents and whatever machinations and bribes they've been arranging to get rid of me. Now it's time I take matters into my own hands. I may not be a real, official person, according to the only humans left alive on Earth, but maybe I can be in charge of my own destiny. For one night, at least. Dimly, miserably, I'm aware that I'll have to conform to whatever my parents arranged for me. I'll have new lens implants that'll mark me as a different person, and somehow a new family to fit that identity. But right now I want to take a taste of everything I've been missing all these years. Everything I was entitled to. I didn't realize it until a few minutes ago. I climb once again to the top of the high courtyard wall. Eden glitters all around me. A mix of the greenish-blue fairy lights of bioluminescence from the modified microorganisms that permeates the city at night, providing a base light, and the electric glow that lights up wherever a human moves. I can see a living diorama in flashes of light all around me, the people showing up as deeply contrasting shadows. There, just down the block, a neighbor I've never met, and never will, opens his front door and steps into the night. For a fraction of a second, the city seems to examine him. Then, as if the very street itself must have decided to accept him, it lights up beneath his feet. He walks on in the direction of the entertainment district, and the light leads him on, following his footsteps just long enough to let him know he's not forsaken. I watch his personal light grow smaller in the distance, a will-o'-the-wisp from Mom's old stories that seems to call me. From my height, I can see the lights of several people from our circle all heading towards another ring, where they'll be going to parties, clubs, restaurants, the theater. If only I had someplace to go, someone who was waiting for me to arrive. I picture myself entering a party, all of my friends calling my name, beckoning me over. Someone hands me a drink. Another cracks a joke about something we've all shared. I am welcome. I am accepted.